This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, February 24th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel plans to reduce Army manpower to its lowest level since before World War II. That may look like a dramatic shift, but much of that is to be expected. Technological innovation and winding down wars should save Americans money. Chris Preble, Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, comments.
How much of what Secretary Hagel is proposing is something that should be expected?
I think most of it should be expected given that, given the budget realities, that we are still in a serious deficit situation, that the budget, there are budget caps in place. Of course, they were relaxed modestly by the Ryan-Murray compromise that was negotiated back in December, but there are still spending caps in place, and so the Pentagon had to do certain things to get under those caps. More generally, the war in Iraq is over, the war in Afghanistan is drawing down, and there is very little enthusiasm on the part of the American people for additional wars, appropriately, because those kinds of wars that we were planning to fight in the 2000s turned out to be very costly and unnecessary to U.S. security, and I would argue actually harmful to U.S. security by drawing us into other people's political disputes.
Now, this is from the New York Times story on the subject. These are from Pentagon officials speaking anonymously. One result, the officials argue, will be a military capable of defeating any adversary but too small for protracted foreign occupations.
To which I and most Americans would say, good. That's slightly tongue-in-cheek, of course. What the Pentagon worries about, and I think with some justification, is that while they are going to have fewer assets, fewer people to deploy around the world, there will still be the desire on the part of policymakers on this side of the Potomac to send that smaller force in lots and lots of places. So as with everything, we have a potential means versus ends gap, and my goal has always been, since I've been here, to focus on the ends. But the Pentagon, by necessity and by tradition, is focused on the means. They can't really change, or at least they're subject to being to having the ends change, but without a lot of input from them.
Now, the headline that is being thrown around is essentially that we would have the smallest military since before World War II. Isn't that to some extent also to be expected given technological innovation and the benefits of that?
Exactly. We do lots of things with fewer people, from farming to manufacturing to me doing things around the house that I used to rely on other people to do because of technology and because of access to more things. Again, on a more serious note, the active duty Army will probably come down about 450,000 troops or so, maybe a little bit less than that. To put that in perspective, the high point of the post 9/11 force was about 566,000. And the average in the late 1990s is about 480,000. So it's really coming more in line with where we were during the 1990s. And I think based on what we knew from that period and what we've learned since, a force that large is more than sufficient for dealing with short notice contingencies. And if you know, in the unlikely event that we needed more troops, we could raise them. I think that is highly unlikely. I also think that we're drawing down our permanent presence in Europe, and part of that presence that was so much larger in the 1990s, because you will have fewer troops permanently stationed in Germany, especially in a few other European countries, that also would allow you to have a smaller active duty force total here at home.
What are the benefits that Americans should be able to point to when it comes to shrinking the military in this way?
Well, the main thing is money, savings. Is that the personnel costs are the largest share and a rising share of the Pentagon's budget, and I think that's to be expected. We attract very, very highly qualified, motivated people. We train them well. We want them to take a career in the military, or at least to serve long enough to actually use their skills that they receive during their training. And that force is unquestionably the best in the world. It costs money. It turns out that it's rather difficult politically to change the benefit packages for people who are already in service or who have since retired but continue to, you know, to operate on the assumption that the benefits they were promised when they were on active duty will continue. And again, we can have a debate on whether or not that's a reasonable expectation given the circumstances. But because it is politically difficult to, as we say, bend the cost curve down, the only other way to save money is to have fewer people. You have fewer people, they tend to be – they will be well qualified, they will be well – well trained, and they will be exceptionally motivated. That's all to the good. And in fact, you know, of course, the proposal that Ben Friedman and I put out several years ago did reduce end strength quite significantly. We did not put specific proposals for reducing spending on personnel and benefit on personnel benefits. If anything, we said you would have a even more elite, well compensated force than the slightly larger one that we were cutting into. This was in 2010, of course, when we published our policy analysis, military budgetary savings from military restraint.
When a soldier signs on the dotted line, there are costs that just go out for decades. Can
Correct.
You talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, it's pretty well established over time that you can make certain assumptions about when that soldier signs on the dotted line, what percentage of them will finish basic training, what percentage of them will finish their first enlistment, what percentage of them will re-enlist, et cetera, et cetera. And you can make certain judgments about how much money you have to set aside to pay their benefits if, in fact, they stay in the service through 20 years and are eligible for a full retirement. Of course, only a small percentage actually do reach that level, but everyone who participates, you know, it's a math problem, basically, a complicated one, but a math problem nonetheless. And so I do think, while it has proven extremely difficult to change the benefit package for existing troops and for those who are retired but who, again, entered the service with certain expectations, I do think it's politically possible to make changes to new enlistees so that they're essentially entering with a new set of expectations.
What happens to the Navy under Secretary Hagel's plan?
Well, it appears that they're committed, at least in principle, to retaining 11 aircraft carriers. There was some talk about going down to 10, but one of the aircraft carriers, the George Washington, which is scheduled for kind of refueling and refit, et cetera, that appears that they're still planning on it. In order to do that, they're talking about retiring about 11 cruisers, or at least putting 11 cruisers in some sort of a kind of a down state, you know, not fully ready state. I'm not entirely sure how that all plays out. I really want to see the details on that. You know, we are building new destroyers. The new destroyers arguably are as capable as the cruisers. The cruiser, of course, is one of the ships that I deployed on many years ago. They've changed over the years, but the basic structure is the same. So I'd like to see that. The other thing that I've heard a little bit about, but not enough, is of course there is pressure on the shipbuilding budget being exerted by the plan to build a new ballistic missile submarine, a nuclear missile submarine, and they haven't sorted that out. I haven't seen in the early releases. Perhaps they're going to talk about this later today. I haven't seen what the plans are for accommodating that additional spending in the shipbuilding budget for the ballistic missile submarine.
What is missing, as far as you can tell?
Well, there are certain assumptions in terms of the budget that they're going to have, and they're making some assumptions that they're going to shake out some additional money from Congress somehow, either through closing of tax loopholes, that is, increasing taxes, or again, you would expect that the pushback would be for finding cuts elsewhere in the domestic discretionary budget. The White House probably isn't going to sign on to that. So if we're continuing to confront this impasse between no more revenue and no more cuts elsewhere in the budget, then it seems to me they're sort of whistling past the graveyard that they think they're going to find this money somehow. I don't know how that will play out. You'd say, of course, how's the saying go? The White House proposes and the Congress disposes the budget. So if the Congress ultimately decides not to abide by the spending caps, it's on Congress, not on the White House and the Pentagon. But that seems a little cynical. So I would have liked to have seen a budget that was more closely aligned with the current law, and if by some miracle they find additional money or additional some sort of deal that frees up money, then they can budget for more. But it seems a little irresponsible to just assume that additional money is going to be found somewhere.
Chris Preble is Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work about where to cut at the Pentagon and still defend the United States at cato.org.